Howdy, listener, and thanks for tuning into our podcast, The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. My name is Izzy.
And my name is David. Each week, one of us will pick a movie that the other has not seen. We will deep dive into our individual takes and historical background of the movie.
Please subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Instagram at TML A Journey Through Cinema and Twitter at TML A Journey. Today we are going to discuss the film Bite the Bullet, written and directed by Richard Brooks, starring Gene Hackman, Candice Bergen, and James Coburn. So, why did you choose this film?
Well, I remember watching this film years ago and liking it and eventually adding it to our movie collection. I was always struck by how this film should be remembered more than it is, due to the fact that the cast is full of Oscar-nominated actors, that the director is an Oscar-nominated. The film is about a race. It's a horse race from a 700-mile horse race. And there's 15 contestants that sign up. All of them are different, but it focuses on six. There's two ex-Rough Riders. One of them is played by Gene Hackman, and the other one is played by James Coburn. That's where they know each other. There's a woman of ill repute who joins the race to win. That's played by Candice Bergen. There is an old-timer played by Ben Johnson who wants to go out on top. His casting is definitely a callback to the fact that he's been in Westerns since the 40s and 50s. There's Ian Bannon, who's a Scottish sportsman who comes all the way from England to race against the best. And then there's a young kid who tries to, he's basically trying to make a name for himself and be famous, like real cowboys. And there's also a Mexican writer who's coming in to win the money for his family. And I feel like it's one of those movies that just kind of got forgotten in time. And when you start looking back on it, you start to realize why it was forgotten. What happened in 1975 that led to it not being a top movie at the time?
So, I wasn't there, but you were. What happened in 1975?
Well, you have to remember, I was only 5 years old. Bite the Bullet came out in June 25th, 1975. The movie that came out the week previous was Jaws. June 20th, Jaws came out. And when Jaws hit the theaters, it literally became the first modern day blockbuster. It sets the rules for all the blockbuster rules that we follow now. The reason why we get excited about a movie making over $100 million is set because of Jaws. The term blockbuster and people lying around the block is coming from Jaws. A lot of the things that studios look for when they talk about tentpole films for summertime, where now they're going out of their way to create blockbuster films, comes from the fact that Jaws made, in 1975 money, $133 million. To put that in perspective, the top grossing film the year before made $50 million. So what that is telling you is that the chances of having huge hits that can save whole studios, and in later on would also take, you know, bankrupt certain studios when they didn't hit. Those type of things it changed the way that we look at movies. And there were certain movies that came out that year that have since been looked at and gone, oh yeah, I remember that film. That film came out in 1975, and they did not perform well in the theater because, let's face it, they came out in the 2.5 months after Jaws came out. There were a number of films that didn't perform well in July and August, and Bite the Bullet was one of those. I mean, there were still hits before Jaws, and there were movies that they would say was a big hit, but now people actually went to the trades to see how much money the movie had made versus whether or not a movie could still be somewhat successful and still be considered a good movie. It now was part and parcel with whether or not we can deem that movie successful.
I've seen Jaws, and when watching this movie and knowing that it came out after Jaws, it still, to me, it felt very dated. Most of the Westerns that I have watched were made in the 60s and early 70s. When Jaws came out the same time as Bite the Bullet feels very dated. The way that it's shot, the scenery, even the dialogue, and the fact it's a character heavy movie and a character driven movie, it feels very dated.
Oh, that's funny, because I actually have some of the opposite feelings. I find that I look at movies like Bite the Bullet that were made in the 70s or the early 60s, and what the Westerns that were made then, actually to be feeling as dated as some of the movies that are being made now that are Westerns. I've tried to watch modern Westerns that are made now. The stories are very old-fashioned. Sheriff, town, girl that he's trying to win or ends up winning. Very basic storytelling. I find these movies from Bite the Bullet especially to be not as dated feeling. There are things that, like, you look at the filming of it. Yeah, the camera doesn't move around as much. There are larger set pieces that can lead people to feeling that it's dated. It's also the pacing is a little bit more deliberate and less frantic than some modern films would be. Especially with a race as its main focus.
So, Dad, in 1975, do you think Westerns were on their way out before Jaws?
Well, yeah, that's kind of a question. That question has kind of multi-points. One, I don't think Westerns were going out because of Jaws. Jaws affected a lot of other genre films, too. Jaws affected how films were planned and made moving forward. When Spielberg made Close Encounters of the Third Kind and Star Wars came out 2 years later, those movies cemented the blockbuster as a way of making films. On the other part of your question is, were Westerns on their way out? Yeah, they were on their way out. Not as many were being made as there used to be. There used to be a lot more television shows that were Westerns. And then you had movies that were coming out that were Westerns. So you can say almost like in the 50s and through the 60s, there was more Westerns being made because of television, the weekly television part, and the films. And by the 70s, that had really slowed down. There's another film that came out not too long after this film called Hooper, about stuntmen that Burt Reynolds was in. And one of the things that they keep talking about is they all know how to do horse stunts because that's what they were trained on, and nobody is asking them to do horse stunts, and they all their stuff is action stuff and falls from buildings. So there was definitely two things. Yes, Westerns were going out. They were expensive to make because of horses and stunts. They're also, let's face it, people felt that they were passe because they weren't going beyond the Western tropes in a lot of cases. You also have to realize, too, that the studios were in trouble. The studio system was falling apart after the late 60s. And during the 70s, they were trying to figure out how to make hits and movies again. You had, even though you had film students that had studied Westerns and studied John Ford and studied Howard Hawks in film, and these guys were now coming out and directing films, they weren't making those films themselves. There's elements of those films in the films that they're making, but they weren't making new Westerns. And in fact, a lot of the cop films from the 70s, 80s are pretty much straightforward modern day Westerns, where you basically have the sheriff, i.e. the cop, fighting either a corrupt system, i.e. a corrupt town, trying to save a woman, i.e. the woman that is in every single Western or in these comedies, or trying to survive bad guys after them. It's much easier to shoot bad guys when they're not dressed as Indians either, because Native Americans were at that point, people were starting to see that, oh, these weren't just standard bad guys. They're actually people. We actually took their land, and people started reexamining the history. So making a Western became harder to make, and nobody likes to go into a Western and go, oh, I'm not exactly sure who the bad guy is, who the good guy is. I actually like those films. I actually like the Westerns that are like, who's the good guy, who's the bad guy? Ask those questions, which is one of the reasons why I like this film. Richard Brooks was really trying to write a movie that dealt with a lot of different things. He dealt with it because it's a horse race and the West is closed because it's 1906 when the film takes place. It's based on a real race that happened in 1908, put on by the Denver Post. So he was trying to address a few things. One, how people were treated. So there is racism. There is how we treated animals in that film. There's definitely animal cruelty is definitely one of the themes in that film. And there's also different aspects of what really makes a good person and a bad person.
If you say Westerns are going out during this time, why do you think studios were putting money into making large pieces like this?
It actually wasn't that large of a Western. It had a very minimal budget. They only spent $3 to $4 million making it, which even the 1975 money wasn't that much when you consider how much they had to spend for the actors. It keeps getting this reputation of being a big Western. You'll read some of the reviews from the time saying a big Western by Richard Brooks. Well, Richard Brooks was a well-known director, but he was also towards the end of his career. And so he wasn't being given a lot of movies. In fact, this was like 4 years in between his last movie and this movie. The $3 to $4 million that he used to make this film, it's one of those movies where you can say everything that he spent the money on, you can see on the screen. He had an amazing cinematographer that did a really great job of using the area they shot in. They also shot in non-traditional Western spots. When you see a lot of Westerns, they're shot in Monument Valley, or they're shot in Utah or Northern California. So they look very similar to a lot of Westerns that were coming out of that period. And he went to White Sands, New Mexico. He went to places in Nevada. He went on to the train was really important for the race because the train follows the race, so the train's at every different stop of the race. He went to a railroad that went from New Mexico to Colorado that was still being run at the time, so he could film the actual engines that were being used during that time period. He spent time filming it so it looks bigger than it is. And I think that's a thing people tend to look at Westerns. When you film wide open spaces, people go, oh, this is a very big Western. And it's like, well, no, actually, it's pretty small. Just the land around them is pretty big. One of the things I wanted to ask you, because you've been asking me a lot of questions about the history of the movie, is did you enjoy the film?
I did enjoy the film. There was a little part where I was kind of going, when is the story going? Like I do at all Westerns. You know me. I'm a 21st century kid. If there's not explosions in the first 5 minutes, it's kind of boring. I actually really enjoyed
it. Oh, boy, you're really not going to like some of the films I have selected then.
Well, you know, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was pretty cool. I thought the character growths were warranted. I thought the story was told beautifully. It actually reminded me of a lot of the plays that we put on at school that are character-heavy, dialogue-heavy plays. Especially that one scene where it's just Gene Hackman and Candace Bergen just... they're at a watering hole, and it's literally like a 5-minute scene, and all he's doing is telling her about his wife, and it's just a monologue about, like, I wasn't worth her sweat, you know, and why he wasn't worth his sweat, and that to me was very reminiscent of, like, of character-heavy, plot-light, modern-day plays.
I'm glad you brought that scene up, that kind of defines the movie for me is the fact that there, on the surface, there is the West as it's been portrayed. there's the legends of the West. And in that scene, at the beginning of the scene, remember, she asks him about San Juan Hill, and he gives her the legend of San Juan Hill. We charged up, we won the day, we did all this amazing things. And he's about to ride off to continue the race as she's going to drink some water and give some water to her horse. Then he turns around and comes back and he goes, no, that wasn't the way it was at all. And he tells her the truth, which also ties into the fact why he is so angry about people mistreating people. He married somebody who was Cuban. She was Cuban. She was part of the insurrection. And she was then killed as part of this battle. And when he tells her that he wasn't worth her spit, he really means it. It tells you that for the rest of this movie, from that moment on in this movie, the legend part of these characters is going to be really examined. You even have when the old timer, played by Ben Johnson, is telling him all the things that he did in the West. If you listen to the list of the things he did, I mean, there's always the cowboy part, but he was also a spittoon man. He worked in a hotel. There's all the things that he listed that aren't the glamorous Western jobs. And so when he's telling you, I want to win this race so people can remember me because I didn't have a very, very memorable life. And so you're sitting there going, they're not going to sit here and tell you that Ben Johnson at one point was the biggest, baddest cowboy ever. No, he was just a guy who was trying to survive in the West. And I think that's the thing that has always drawn me back to this film. It is an understated film, like you said. It's very understated at the beginning. The race is shot beautifully. There's some great photography through it. The use of slow motion, the use of the areas around White Sands is gorgeous.
I honestly, the set, a lot of these set pieces are like postcards. They're really beautiful.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things too that probably drew people to this film. One of the things that I really respected is that everybody who was an actor in that film was a horse rider. Even Candace Bergen, who grew up on horses, so you could totally tell that they were comfortable around horses. And so when they're riding through the, you're not going, that person's never ridden a horse before in their life.
Which happens a lot now, yeah. Because you can train in the 2.5 weeks before. Like, we talked about this, people who shoot guns in films.
Yes.
You can totally tell when they have taken acting with a gun class and not actually have ever shot a gun before in their life, which I'm a person who's never shot a gun before in my life, but I have friends who have, and you can definitely see the difference. First of all, you know, people who shoot guns, who haven't shot guns, they close their eyes, and it's very noticeable when people are acting on horses. But this movie, I felt like all of these characters were Westerners. They were in that time period. They lived these lives. I wasn't distracted by, you know, Anne Hathaway and Princess Diaries 2. It's a very beautiful crafted story, and it's acted very well by the horses and by humans.
Yeah, and I think people think also two of the movies that Richard Brooks did back in the 60s really, I think, influenced this movie. One of them, of course, is The Professionals, which is the other Western he's known for. I think The Professionals is probably a little bit better of a film than this one. He made it when he was hitting stride. And this one is like when he's like about to wrap up and saying, hey, this is the type of films I was making. And I'm going to let you know that there's a lot of things I have to say that's not traditional. And then the other film that he made in the 60s was called In Cold Blood, which is about two people that murder a family, two guys who murder a family. And the book is based on the book written by Truman Capote. and he shot and he wrote and directed that movie. A lot of people, and so there's a lot more emotional, I think, emotional growth from that film, which he did after The Professional, which is why I think you see more emotion in these characters. They're not the stoic Western characters that you always get.
They're not one-dimensional at all.
Yeah.
Most of them have flaws, and most of them have things that they're fighting for. Like most Westerns, people have things that they're fighting for. That's the whole point of a Western. But the things that they're fighting for are complicated. It's not like I'm fighting for money to buy the town from the old dude. It's I want money because I want my freedom and I want my husband's freedom, but it's complicated because her husband is also in with the bad guys and steals all everybody's horses, and you know, so
it's a subplot.
It's a subplot. You know, so it's very complicated. You know, I want to win because I want to be the biggest and baddest. But then by doing that, you stretch yourself too thin, you kill your horse, and you learn that you actually have to respect human beings before you can be, and the animals before you can be the biggest and baddest. So it's not point A to point B. It's to get to point B, you also have to deal with all the little itty bitty steps. It's a zigzag. It's not straightforward, which I thought was very nice because I like complicated characters. It might be harder to root for the complicated characters, but you can see yourself a lot more into these complicated characters because it's not like, well, this man is a pious man. He goes to church every Sunday. He's super good. And it's like, you can never relate to that man because in the West, because there's nobody like him in real life.
There is, I think starting in the late 50s, Even some of the vehicles that John Wayne was in and some of the Randolph Scott, the characters started getting more complicated. It's hard not to get complicated when you start really reading about the history of the West. And I think that that's one of the things that influenced. And so in the 60s, when people start really examining the history of America and start really re-examining, because so much people were questioning so much in the 60s that it was harder to make these Westerns with those type of characters. And so it gave the filmmakers the chance to really make interesting characters. Ironically, the film that came out that year that had starred John Wayne is called Rooster Cogburn, which is John Wayne's most outlandish Western character. He plays a drunk sheriff who breaks all the rules. And I mean, it's like basically he's not a John Wayne character. The traditional actors at that time for Westerns have moved on from that character, which makes movies like this a lot more accessible. People kind of expect them. But like I said, the genre was considered old-fashioned. I don't know if Jaws never happened, if this movie would still have been, would have been more of a success. That's the big question, is like, did Jaws really influence this film? I think it did, because there is literally a 2-month period where all the films that came out after that weren't successful. That's one of the things I think, okay, it's not just this film. It's the movie Shampoo, which was a big Warren Beatty film that everybody was looking forward to, didn't do as well as people thought. There's a lot of other films. Not until you get into November, December, when One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest comes out, do you get another hit for the year. And I think that's one of the reasons why I always look at this film as kind of a forgotten near classic. I wouldn't call it a classic. I say near classic because it's really well made. It's really good. It's a director that's almost at the top of his game, but not quite. And the cast really, you can tell the cast really enjoyed making the film because they really put all into it. And it's one of those things where I think would have been talked about more if, of course, if the summer had gone a little bit differently that year.
Some reviews of this movie in 1975 had issues with the pacing and the abrupt ending of the movie. Do you have issues with the abrupt ending?
Well, I want to get your answer on this one too, because I think the ending fits.
Me too. I do.
So I think the thing is that people really like that, like to have that after chapter, like when it's all over, like
a neat bow.
Yeah, and that's a bow. And then that wasn't the point of this movie. This was a sporting event. It's like the Super Bowl or a game, a baseball game you go watch. When it's over, you don't hang around and talk to the players and go, hey, so what did you guys think? So what are you going to do now? Basically, what happens is that at the end of the movie, the end of the movie is them crossing the finish line, which I think ties up the movie really well, because all the things that they have said, done through their actions, through their interactions are being tied up in that scene. You see all the other racers who are at the end, who've been knocked out, all the other racers that mattered, except for one that have survived at the end, their reactions to who wins, their reaction, how the race is won, and it tells you everything you need to know. You don't need the ending that people want.
You don't need the yellow writing in the lower third saying 3 years after this he opened a hotel with his earnings. Like you don't need that. This is not that type of movie. The movie is the race.
Yeah.
And if we added anything more, it would have taken away from all of that wonderful character development and the wonderful character driven dialogue about, you know, and taken away from the race.
Yeah. Well, I think, we're taken away from that. And also, the name of the movie is called Bite the Bullet. And at the very end, when they cross the finish line and the look of relief on their face, they are done biting the bullet. They're done doing what needs to get done. I thought it was a really good ending. I thought it was a very unique ending. I thought it was an earned ending. Pacing-wise, there is a little bit in the middle towards the past the midpoint to the last third. It's a little shaggy. There's a subplot that's thrown in there. Well, it's not thrown in there. It's mentioned early in the film, so it doesn't. If you watch the film, it's set up early in the film. What's going to happen? Is it extra? Yeah, it's extra. But it also adds a little bit of adventure to this thing, and it's a little bit more of a 700 mile race. And at a certain point, film watchers get bored with horses running for 700 miles. So even though there's all these other obstacles that have been going on in the race, it was another obstacle thrown their way. And
are you talking about when they got their horses stolen?
Yeah, when they got their horses stolen, and they had to go back and get their horses. And it also gave Dabney Coleman a nice scene for his character, because Dabney Coleman, who a couple years later would play the worst boss in cinematic history in 9 to 5, had a nice little cameo in this movie where he basically had them stop the race so it gave them enough time, because he didn't want his rider to win the race without any competition. So it was a nice little way of saying, hey, this race wasn't going to be won just because you had the most money and you were lucky enough that your horse wasn't stolen. So they went and they had like a little adventure finding the horse, getting the horses back, and going back to the race.
I actually feel like that the horses being stolen subplot was kind of necessary, because this is because of this plot. Of the reason why it's stolen because Candace Bergen's character's husband or boyfriend,
husband
who is a failed bank robber.
There is a work crew from the local from prison working on the train line, fixing the train line, and which is common at that time. And then she joins the race to basically use the race as an excuse to get to. Through the train to get there, to set him free. And she was supposed to just set him free. And of course, he is schemed and there are more, it blows up and it becomes a big deal. And then eventually they get their horses stolen and they go after their horses. They get their horses back. Her husband is killed. And then she rides off into the sunset. Now, the reason she rides off in the sunset, I think, is all the way through the movie, she is being an independent woman, but she also is being, she's being independent-ish. And then when...
she joins the race because of her husband.
Yeah.
And how tries to win the race because of her husband. All the things that are quote-unquote independent are because of her husband.
And once he's dead,
she doesn't have to deal with his shenanigans anymore.
And she rides off into the sunset for a new life. And I think it's one of those things that you look at this and you go, oh, okay, she's her character at this point doesn't need to finish this race because she's gotten out of it what she needs. Yeah. Some of the characters don't survive. The old man, played by Ben Johnson, does not survive. Sorry, spoilers. It's also part of the cycle of life. There's the young kid coming in. There's the old man going out. There's different people for different, doing this race for different reasons. The horses, some of the horses don't survive. Now, no horses were hurt, of course, filming, but animal cruelty is part of is definitely a commentary on animal cruelty. How far men and women push animals to get what they want out of them. And there's also an old saying about how you treat animals, how you treat people. And so I think Richard Brooks, being the writer, he was definitely making a comment on that. Because there's a line at the very beginning that Gene Hackman asks, like, who, the horse doesn't care who wins.
The horse doesn't care who wins the race, neither do I.
Yeah. And so, and then of course because he's an impetuous character and he's an emotional character, he then goes, joins the race because he's going to show them how to do it without mistreating the animal. And of course, when he gets to the end and he's about to win and his horse is failing because he's pushed his horse too much, he stops and lets the horse rest and then walks the horse to the finish line, which allows James Coburn's character to catch up. And James Coburn, even though he's his friend, told him in the beginning, I'm not going to not try to win this race because you're my friend, stops and walks side by side with him, with his horse, and they cross the finish line together. So they both win, which means they win the race. And I think that's why the abrupt ending is the way it is. It's like, that's the ending that you earned in this film. And anything after that would have been superficial.
Well, that's a thing that I didn't know coming into this film. I actually watched the film twice, once with me by myself and once with you. We watched it together. And that's where I can ask the questions of, like, I noticed this throughout the film. The horses get all soapy and... and I was like, is there like this disease on the animal? I'm super confused on what's happening with this horse. And I found out that that's how the horses froth when they sweat. And if they sweat too much and froth too much, they inevitably
could die,
which actually happens to
one of the horses.
I want to say this, and I've been trying to get into the podcast. I find it cute and I find it adorable that the horses are actors themselves and they're trained to look dead, but horses are super friendly creatures. So once they say cut and their trainer and handler are like, okay, you can get up now, they want to make sure the human knows that they're alive. So if you feel really bad and you want to, like, have a really great day, look up on the internet horses playing dead because they act like puppies. It's adorable.
They pop up and start licking people.
Yeah,
nudging people and hey, I'm good to go.
Yeah. So if you ever have a bad day, I just wanted to say that out loud.
No, it makes sense too, because this, like I said, because one of the themes in this film is animal how we treat our animals, and they do portray animals dying because of the stress put on by humans, which is distressing. And the thing that I find. The thing that I find about it is like, it's like when you think about it, I've watched, I don't know how many countless Westerns. I mean, seriously, I watched a ton of Westerns growing up, and animal mistreatment and how animals are ridden hard all the time in Westerns, and they're not shown the effects of how it really affects the animal. And so this film went out of its way to show you actually how it affects the animal, how riding 700 miles on an animal in a race really does affect the animal. And I think that's one of the things that makes the movie interesting for me too, because it's like you have non-traditional characters, you have two strong women. Yes, you have women talking freely about sex in a film in 1975 that's set in the West, dealing with things like heroin used as a painkiller because it's sold over the counter, all these things that are in the West that aren't normally put into Westerns at that time. You do get some of that stuff in modern Westerns in some of the TV shows like Deadwood and
Hateful Eight, which is not a TV show, but it's a movie, but they do talk about like hygiene is a thing that happens in Hateful Eight.
Yeah, and there's definitely things like in Hateful Eight and Django Unchained, and then of course Hell on Wheels, and a couple more of the modern stuff that is a little bit more diverse.
While you were saying about animal cruelty, it just popped in my head. But I think the first time that anybody talked about animal cruelty in a Western was Mel Brooks's Blazing Saddles.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a joke.
And that was the year before.
Yeah, and that was the year before. And that was a joke. It's like when the dude goes out and like punches the horse in the face. Like that was, yeah, he punches the horse in the face.
Yeah.
Yeah. He punches the horse in the face. And that was played for a joke. And they were talking, you know, and...
And in this movie, they have almost the exact same scene, and it's not played for a joke, and there's repercussions from it.
Yeah, it starts a fight. So, Dad,
mm-hmm.
You have some notes here. What are your final thoughts on this movie? Does it hold up? To me, I think it does hold up. I think it's a wonderful interpretation of what a Western could be, and honestly, I feel like we could make it during this time, maybe with a more diverse cast. But I definitely do feel like this is a movie that we could make in 2020.
Yeah, there would be changes, but yes. I mean, I think if James Coburn plays a character who's half Cherokee, and I think in today's world, we would cast that character differently.
So, how would you rate this movie? Would you give it 4 out of 5 stars, 3 out of 5 stars?
I'd give like 4 stars out of 5. Like I said, it's a near classic. It's a movie that does really – near classic sounds so pretentious. Sorry. I would consider it a near classic in the fact that it does so much with what it has. And I don't have to look at a movie and go, it has to be this big, bold movie to be a classic. There's some very nice, small films that I consider classics. So I don't know. I would give it like 4 out of 5 stars. So I do know. And I find that the more that I've watched this movie in my 20s, I've watched it in my 30s, and I've watched it in my 40s now. I feel like it. Each time I've watched it, I've came out at a different perspective, and there's something that I've learned about the film, and it's a little deeper than some other films. There's movies I've gone back and watched, and I just can't. I can't believe at one point I thought this was a good film, and so this movie actually holds up.
I would give it probably the same amount. I would probably give it 3.5 to 4. I think it's a beautifully crafted film. I think it's a wonderfully character-driven film. One of my favorite bits in the whole film is, you know, no line. There was, like, no lines. It's just everybody's face in the camera. And that's how they're telling the reaction. I think it when movies do that, you can see how wonderfully it's acted. I honestly think it's a really good Western.
Having watched, 12 Westerns?
Yeah, having watched 12 Westerns, which a handful of them is what you would consider a classic Western, you know, the good and the bad and the ugly and for a few dollars more and things like that. But I've also seen some poopers, and I've seen some Westerns that I will never see again, and frankly is where I get my disdain for the Western genre, because I've seen those movies and I've seen they're just boring, you know, they're just, you know, they're shooting at indigenous people for no apparent reason except for the fact that they're indigenous people, and it's, you know, there's race, they're the character, main character's racist and things like that. But I think this is actually a pretty good one. It's actually Western movie side.
So we talked about how the movie was, what we liked about the movie. Was there any drawbacks or anything about the film that you didn't like, that you thought could have been stronger?
Well, I am particularly not fond of white people being cast in roles that are of people of color, you know, I'm not a big fan of, you know, I think it was Cherokee that they said, I'm half Cherokee, but it's like, you're white as sour cream. I don't, you know, it takes me right out of the movie. And that's definitely a 21st century way of thinking. That's the 21st century way of thinking that I don't think I could ever get rid of, even for trying to be non-biased towards a film. I thought most of the dialogue and most of the film was fast-paced, and I didn't feel like a lot of the scenes didn't sag for me. There was a few pieces of, there's a few sadnesses for me. I don't like it when animals die in movies. I don't care if humans die. I just, I'm one of those people, like many people out there, who just can't handle it when an animal dies. And that was kind of sad for me. I've never really seen a horse die in a Western.
Well, you still haven't. I mean, they just did a really good job of making you think you saw a horse die.
Yeah, but I've never seen a horse die in a Western that wasn't, like, offhand, you know, because there's those big battles in Westerns sometimes, and horses do die, but they don't really give them any.
It's like Lord of the Rings, where they're all charging in, and all of a sudden half the horses get taken out. It's like you don't really think about it.
Yeah.
But I think the thing is about this film that the one drawback that it's really hard for me to get around, I think I've made my peace with it, is the dialogue and the pacing is pretty good. And then, like I said, in the middle, there's a couple characters that just kind of disappear. I mean, you know what happened to a couple of them. They either die or they get knocked out of the race. But you never go back to them again in the context of the race. Like, they're there at the end, so you know that they went back to the train and they got taken to the end, but there's no, like, resolution for their characters. I don't know if they really – and at this time watching it, I don't know if you really need a resolution for those characters. They were not the main characters. But I used to think when I was younger, when I watched the film the first or second time, I was like, it would have been really nice to have one or two shots of those characters on the train or doing something as part of the race versus just showing up at the end, some of them without their horses because they didn't survive, some of them changed people because of what happened. So it would have been, I think, a nicer ending if there was a little bit more tie-in with those characters. But again, I mean, the movie runs at 2 hours long. It's not, doesn't feel like it's 2 hours. And maybe if they started putting a lot of that extra stuff in there, you would start going, no, this, they're showing me stuff I don't think I need to see. So that to me is a creative choice. I also feel that the young character's redemption comes a little easy at the end. Jan Michael Vincent plays a young racer, and he does some pretty despicable things and says some pretty despicable things. And I think by the end, when he, quote unquote, his redemption story happens, it's a little given to him a little easily.
I honestly believe that because the ending is so abrupt, I think a lot of it is you can interpret it any way you want.
Yeah.
You know, you can interpret it. Did they live a good life? Did they live a bad life? Did they live a horrible life? Did the, you know, horses live on a pasture with, because their owners just won $2,000, which is about 56,000 here, or, you know, in 2020, you know, are they, you know, so it's, I think it's up to the people watching the film to see if the characters actually changed enough to be redemed.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, those are small nitpicky things. So generally I like the film. Generally I like the dialogue. I like the plotting, the pacing. So yes, I would recommend it. Next week, Izzy has picked out a romantic film that I haven't seen. She knows I have a soft spot for a good romantic story. It's one of those things that I will watch a bad romantic comedy and be really upset about if it's bad. But if it's good, I am super excited about. So she says she found one for me, and we're going to watch it next week.
If you want to watch the film with us, you can rent Bite the Bullet now on Amazon Prime. It's also on Google Play, iTunes, and YouTube. It's also included with a Starz membership, according to this website. You can get hints on what films we are watching if you follow us on our Instagram account at TML A Journey Through Cinema.
Thank you for listening, and keep watching films.
Bye. See you next week.